Coon Review Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CoeNReview. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@coeNReview.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
This is from the Herald on Wednesday, the 19th of July, 2023. This is from the news section. The headline reads, Cost of Living. Celebrated Scottish restaurant announces closure. This article is by Sarah Campbell. A celebrated Scottish restaurant has announced its closure as a result of the mounting pressures caused by the cost of living crisis. The family-run Monad Kitchen was first opened in Newkirk Road in Bearsden in 2017 and quickly became a neighbourhood favourite thanks to a menu packed with local produce. Later recognised with a prestigious Bib Gourmand rating in 2018, a Michelin Guide entry said of the restaurant, "This delightful neighbourhood restaurant is personally run by husband and wife team, and from the tartan themed decor to the ingredients on the place screams Scotland. Appealing, seasonally evolving menus see classic Scottish cooking given a contemporary twist. Desserts are a highlight." Despite the Monad Kitchen's enduring popularity, owner Charlene and Martin last night said that they were devastated to reveal that the business could no longer be sustained in the current economic climate. A statement read, "It is with a heavy heart that we announce the closure of Monad Kitchen. The financial burden of the world we live in has forced us to close with immediate effect. Managing through COVID to then head into a cost of living crisis has been the most difficult challenge for all small independent businesses, so please continue to support local." The duo went on to thank their customers for years of loyal support and said that the closure of the business would allow them to prioritise their family's health and well-being going forward. "We have given everything we possibly could. However, it is no longer enough. We are devastated to be leaving such a wonderful area and customers we now consider friends after the past 6 years. Your support will never be forgotten, as we could never have done this without you. We are grateful for everything and will cherish the memories we've made." That article was by Sarah Campbell. This is from the Herald on Wednesday, the 19th of July, 2023. This is from the news section. The headline reads, Dan Wooten. Criminal allegations against me are simply untrue. This article is by Jodie Harrison. TV presenter Dan Wooten has admitted errors of judgment but denied criminal allegations. He used his self-titled GB News show to brand claims that he used a pseudonym and offered colleagues money for sexual material simply untrue. The publishers of Mail Online, where he writes a column, and his previous employers at the Sun newspapers said they are looking into allegations made against the New Zealand-born star. Wooten said, "I, like all fallible human beings, have made errors of judgment in the past, but the criminal allegations being made against me are simply untrue. I would like nothing more than to address those spurious claims. I could actually spend the next 2 hours doing so, but on the advice of my lawyers, I cannot comment further." He told viewers that highly politicised social media has made him understand the political threats facing this country. Speaking about GB News on his Dan Wooten Tonight show, he added, "What we're trying to do here is something different, to give a voice to the long forgotten people of the United Kingdom." In his 6-minute opening monologue, he described social media as a cesspit. Wooten, who is known for his role in breaking the story of Mexit, the withdrawal of the Duke and Duchess of Sussex from royal duties, announced in January 2021 that he would be leaving his job as executive editor at The Sun, where he previously edited the paper's Bizarre column. He has since become a columnist for Mail Online, owned by DMG Media, which also publishes the Daily Mail and Metro newspapers. He was previously Showbiz editor at the News of the World and appeared on ITV's Lorraine as a Showbiz correspondent and was named Showbiz Reporter of the Year at the British Press Awards on three occasions. A DMG Media spokesman said, "We are aware of the allegations and are looking into them." A spokesman for News UK, publisher of The Sun, said, "We are looking into the allegations made in recent days. We are not able to make any further comment at this stage." Wootton returned to GB News on Monday, telling viewers he took a break last week to see family in New Zealand. GB News declined to comment. The article was by Jody Harrison. This is from The Herald on Wednesday, the 19th of July, 2023. This is from the news section. The headline reads, "Inside the NHS. Landscape for Alzheimer's is changing, but can the NHS adapt?" This article is by Helen McArdle. In the space of 9 months, the world has gone from having no drug treatments for Alzheimer's to having two. After decades where patients had nothing except medications to manage their symptoms, clinical trials have shown that both lecanemab and now donanemab significantly slow the progression of the disease. In a country such as Scotland, with an ageing population, this is undoubtedly good news. The real challenge, however, is how the NHS can adapt to this new landscape for Alzheimer's. It may come as a surprise, but we don't know how many people in Scotland actually have Alzheimer's disease. As of 2015, it was estimated that there were up to 90,000 people in Scotland affected by dementia, according to Public Health Scotland. That's nearly one in every 50 people living here, and it's a number that is only set to climb. That estimate was based on population screening studies carried out in parts of Europe around 15 years ago, however, which were then used to extrapolate what the prevalence might be for Scotland. In 2016, the Scottish Government tried to get a more accurate projection for incidence. It gathered data on diagnoses from three health board regions, Lanarkshire, Greater Glasgow and Clyde, and Ayrshire and Arran, and used this to predict that by 2020, we should have been diagnosing 19,473 people a year with dementia across Scotland as a whole. This was said to give an accurate reflection of Scottish rates without relying on estimates calculated from data gathered in other nations, but even then was complicated by differences in data collection between health board regions. Furthermore, dementia and Alzheimer's disease are not one and the same. Dementia, characterised by a decline in cognitive functions such as memory, reasoning and language, is a symptom of Alzheimer's disease, but there are other forms such as Lewy body and vascular dementia. Roughly 60-70% of dementia cases are believed to be caused by Alzheimer's. Accurate diagnosis will be vital, however, as lecanemab and donanemab are only effective in Alzheimer's. Until now, there was little incentive to detect Alzheimer's disease at an early stage because nothing could be done to treat it. If lecanemab and donanemab are approved by UK regulators, that will have to change, and that's a big problem for the NHS. Both drugs are most effective when administered early, but at present, fewer than 1% of patients seen by dementia clinics across the UK have an accurate diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease. There are only two methods of correctly identifying it. One is by a lumbar puncture to extract spinal fluid, which can then be analysed for the amyloid protein biomarker, which signals the disease, but this is invasive. The second is a brain imaging using a PET scanner, but the UK has less than half the European average of PET scanners per million people. In Scotland, the NHS has 4 PET centres in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Aberdeen and Dundee, but they are already close to full capacity just from dealing with 6,500 specialist cancer scans annually at a cost of around £1,000 per scan. Yet, if estimates are correct, we should be diagnosing around 12,000 to 13,000 Alzheimer's cases a year by now. Any push to rapidly expand the PET capacity through additional machines, however, would be hindered by the very limited availability of staff skilled to use them. Then there is the question of who we prioritise for screening in the first place. Like cancer, NHS resources would have to be allocated on a delicate risk-benefit calculation to individuals considered to be at the highest risk of the Alzheimer's, who also have the most to gain from being diagnosed early. When the lecanemab results were unveiled last November, Professor John Hardy, an expert in the molecular biology of neurological diseases at University College London, said he could envisage a brave new world where people would receive cholesterol-style blood tests on their 60th birthdays to check their amyloid levels. Reliable diagnostic blood tests would be a big help, and they do appear to be moving closer. As of this week, patients at private clinics in Hong Kong can pay for a Plasmask AD blood test, which will be used to provide a personalised risk score for Alzheimer's, ranging from low to high. It is based on research showing that the amyloid proteins in the blood can be used to diagnose the presence and progression of Alzheimer's disease. This is important because the time lag between disease onset and the start of symptoms in the form of cognitive impairment is thought to be anything from 10 to 20 years. In the UK, large trials of these kind of blood tests are already underway, including a £5 million project funded by Alzheimer's Society and Alzheimer Research UK, exploring how they could be integrated into NHS to speed up early diagnosis and prescribing. This is a time to be optimistic, said Susan Mitchell, Head of Early Detection at Alzheimer's Research UK. That article was by Helen McArdle.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Wednesday, the 19th of July, 2023, from the Voices section. We were not all at sea in another CalMac drama. This article is by Alison Rowett. A new fly-on-the-wall documentary starts this Sunday on BBC Scotland. Island Crossings gets up close and personal with ferry operator Caledonian McBrain and its passengers as another busy year of sailings begins. Thank heavens the cameras were not filming at Ardrossan Harbour a few weeks ago. It was there one Saturday that a dreadful day unfolded. I'm reluctant to write of it for fear of the trauma returning, but here goes. Readers, I give you my ferry hell, what it's really like to be caught in CalMac's jaws of doom. We had turned up en masse, en famille, for the annual trip to Arran. It has become a fixture on the calendar as firm as Christmas. For the past few years, however, it has not been easy to get there and back without drama. You know why, but for the benefit of any foreign visitors, CalMac's ferries are knackered, average age 24. The Scottish Government ordered new ones, but they are now years late and massively, chronically, embarrassingly over budget. As a result, recent trips to Arran have involved cancellations and delays, but we always got there in the end. Not this day. We were booked on the 9:45 to Brodick. In the queue early, small people and dog excited, can't wait to get there and start the holiday. The sailing time came and went, still parked in the queue. The word went from car to car, it's too windy to sail. In Scotland, in July, in a great hunk of steel built to withstand the worst of the weather, a few unfortunate members of staff were sent out to spread the word. They were quickly doughnutted by anxious passengers wondering what to do. Some were told to wait, there might be space on the next ferry, or cancel and rebook for later in the day. No, they couldn't say when or if there would be sailings. Welcome to Scotland. As often happens when travelling on public transport, I had an out-of-body experience. It's the only way to avoid the screaming abdabs. There I was, flying above the harbour, Alison Livingston Seagull. I could see knocked passengers, some of them from London, judging by the crease in their shorts and foreign number plates, people giving up and driving off. Chaos. Last bird out of Saigon, first day of the next sail territory. Worst of all were the Waynes. How do you explain to a tearful three-year-old the ocean-going omni-shambles that is Scotland's ferry crisis? I could have had a go. I could have expanded on commissioning mistakes and contractual pitfalls. But unless something similar had happened in Bluey's world lately, I doubt she would relate. And yes, I could have told her that worse things happen at sea, that we should think ourselves lucky to have such first-world problems. Then I thought, chuff that. All we want to do is travel 14 miles across the Firth of Clyde and enjoy some precious time together. Half a century ago, humankind landed on the moon. In Scotland 2023, we struggle to get to Dunoon. What is wrong with us? I have known SNP supporters shake their heads in bewilderment, wondering why ferries, ruddy ferries, should be the cause of so much Scottish Government earache. But there has always been more to this crisis than first appearances suggest. It is as if we suspect, in our bones, that this local issue speaks to a wider national malaise, that the ferries are a manifestation of deeper problems. By this point, I would have definitely lost the three-year-old's attention, but bear with me. Yes, the ferries are an aging fleet. This accounts for the 67% rise in maintenance costs over 5 years. Yet it's not the whole picture. More sailings mean more maintenance, and more sailings are due to the growing number of people who want to visit the islands or who live and work there. The Ardross and Broderick Crossing is the busiest on CalMac's network, carrying 800,000 passengers a year. This, in short, is a success story, one we have managed to turn into a tale of woe. I say we, but the buck stops with the Scottish Government. Realising which way the wind was blowing, ministers should have camped out at the shipyards till the new vessels were completed. Instead, like everything else, the ferries had to take their place behind independence in the queue for attention. Here's the thing, though. Instead of being a secondary matter, the delivery of the ferries on time and within budget as part of the efficient running of public services as a whole should have been the government's primary focus. And it would have helped the independence cause. If a government can achieve the day-to-day stuff, maybe it is worth hearing out when it comes to pensions, currency, and that long list of other known unknowns. But even this Scottish Government cannot take all the blame for a bad Saturday in Ardrossan. How did we, a country that gave so much to the world, come to limit our horizons so much? If we don't fix what ails us, what kind of Scotland are we leaving for future generations? Long story short, we gave up on the Saturday, went home, and came back the next day. Everyone made it over eventually, despite further cancellations, this time due to staff not turning up. Like many others, they are scunnered with the service, only they get the brunt of the complaints. I was ashamed to see posters asking passengers to please remember that staff too just want to get home safely. That Saturday did it for me. No more Aaron. I don't need the stress. Plenty of places to go on the mainland. Then Aaron worked its magic. In defiance of all forecasts, the sun came out and stayed. Great times were had by all at the swing parks and on the beach. Pizza from the parlour, a toastie from the Little Rock Cafe, anything from Woolies the baker. Another round of crazy golf. You'd be mad not to. Believe the hype. Aaron is Scotland in miniature, paradise on the doorstep. But first you need to get there, and that's a matter of cold, hard practicality, of making the basics work. Of course, we'll be back next year. Aaron has been reprieved by popular demand, and with everything crossed that can be crossed, we will once more travel in hope. The dream shall never die, right enough.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 20th of July 2023, from the Voices section, opinion. It's easy to criticise our politicians, but is it fair? By Rebecca McQuillan, Senior Features Writer. Is British politics, like parts of our overheating world, on the way to becoming unlivable? You have to wonder, given the scores of MPs seizing the opportunity to step down at the next election. 2 weeks ago, the SNP's young star Marie Black announced she would be among them. She was excoriating about the Mother of Parliaments, describing Westminster as outdated, sexist and toxic, explaining, between media attention, social media abuse, threats, constant travel and the murder of two MPs, my loved ones have been in a constant state of anxiety for my health and safety. She added that after nearly a decade in Parliament, I sincerely hope folk will understand my wish to spend more time with my loved ones in a safer environment as I pass the baton to the next candidate. The murder of two MPs, 41-year-old Joe Cox and 69-year-old David Amos, the need for a safer environment, an atmosphere that is sexist and toxic, these remarks speak of frustration, they speak of constant worry. On Tuesday, Philippa Whitford, MP for Central Ayrshire, became the 8th SNP figure to signal an intention to leave, and something like the 70th MP overall so far. There are many reasons why MPs exit Parliament, and Ms Whitford is of retirement age and wants to spend more time with her husband, but she too cited the negative atmosphere. While stressing how rewarding she had found her constituency work, she said, since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister in 2019, aggression and contempt towards SNP MPs, and indeed Scotland, has become the norm, adding that his toxic legacy remains. Now, it must be acknowledged that the forthcoming election is not likely to be much fun for SNP MPs. Some seats that were rock solid are now less secure, with no prospect of the party ever being invited to help form a government, and the main action taking place at Holyrood, becoming an SNP MP has its challenges. That Westminster is decaying and corrupt, meanwhile, is part of the nationalist catchism, so they would blame the system, wouldn't they? But these two MPs' insights into the harsh experience of being parliamentarians ring true, not least because they are supported by survey evidence and the comments of other MPs going back years, particularly women, who despair of Parliament's boys' culture and get the worst of online abuse. How are we supposed to recruit fresh talent to our parliaments if it's seen to be like this? Here's Nicky Morgan, the former Conservative Culture Secretary, who stood down in 2019. She cited the clear impact on my family and the other sacrifices involved in, and the abuse for, doing the job of a modern MP. Liberal Democrat MP Heidi Allen, who also left in 2019, said she was exhausted by the nastiness and intimidation that has become commonplace. It's not just SNP MPs who experienced a worsening political culture after 2019. A 2021 study of tweets sent to women MPs found that digital microaggressions directed at them, positioning women and minority MPs as unqualified and unwelcome in politics, created online a hostile environment for women. Minority ethnic women MPs are particularly badly treated. And, to be clear, it's not just Westminster. A survey for Holyrood magazine 2 years ago found a third of MSPs, and nearly half of female ones, had received death threats, and 70% had felt concerned for their safety since arriving at Holyrood. 29% of female MSPs reported threats of sexual violence. No male MSPs did. On top of all this, MPs live disjointed lives that put immense pressure on their relationships and families. Back in the early days of the Scottish Parliament, one minister's wife had an unofficial club, which consisted of political spouses. They were the POWs, P asterisk 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 ED, off wives, and woe were they fed up, as anyone who came across them in the party conference bar quickly discovered. Their partners had to spend several nights a week at Westminster or Edinburgh, missing their spouses' work crises, the frazzled nights with sick children and the boiler breaking down. Weekends meant constituency surgeries and community council meetings. It's no one's idea of a healthy work-life balance. Yes, it takes ambition and perhaps a degree of egotism to seek such a path, but isn't that true of upwardly mobile people in other professions too, like medicine or law? Being personally ambitious is hardly inimical to believing in public service. Yet 71% of us think members of Parliament are only in it for themselves. The wrongins have a lot to answer for. Cash for questions, Jonathan Aitken, cash for honours, parliamentary expenses. Sleaze has always existed. The Boris Johnson era, however, has abased Parliament. Johnson's elevation to the highest office was like putting Arthur Daly in charge of the Bank of England. The unlawful proroguing of Parliament, the lying to voters, Owen Paterson's egregious breaches of lobbying rules, and the Cabinet's attempts to help him out. Johnson's own inverted lying and partial truths. Standards have been under attack from the inside since 2019. On top of this, we've seen MPs convicted of serious sexual offences. The litany of awful behaviour has inevitably chipped away further at politicians' public standing. They're all the same, a bunch of unrepeatables. It's what you hear ad nauseam. But this is unfair. Patently, politicians are not all the same. Most are unconnected to any scandal. They're just trying to do their job. It's a job that's vital to democracy, but which most of us have zero interest in doing ourselves. If we want to encourage talented people into Parliament in future, it would help if MPs were held in higher esteem. Nobody in any job should have to put up with threats, aggressive emails, being shouted at in the street, sworn at on social media, nor have to install panic alarms at home, said Heidi Allen when she stepped down. No, they shouldn't. A bit more respect for the poor body parliamentary infantry could help restore some health to the sickly system. And that article was by Rebecca McQuillan. From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 20th of July 2023, from the Voices section, Rosemary Goring, Now We Can Start to Dream of a World Without Dementia, by columnist Rosemary Goring. In years to come, July 2023 might well become a date to remember in the annals of medical history. This was the month when a game-changing advance was made in the search for a way to treat Alzheimer's. For decades, scientists have been trying to find a way to combat this wretched disease, but, despite their best efforts, it has continually defied them. Now, it seems, that day has arrived. Results of clinical trials of a drug called donanemab, announced earlier this week, have shown it can slow cognitive decline in those suffering the early stages of Alzheimer's by up to 60%, giving patients another year of relatively normal life. For researchers in this extraordinarily difficult field, it is a pinprick of light at the end of a tunnel that must have seemed, at times, as if it would never end. But light there is, evidence that years of experimentation, of heading up blind alleys and down dead ends before starting again from scratch, are finally starting to pay off. Donanemab, produced by the company Eli Lilly, acts by reducing the build-up in the brain of a protein called amyloid. Scans of patients in the trial show a remarkable reduction in this sticky plaque, which melts away to such an extent that after a year, almost half were able to come off the medication entirely. Patients prescribed donanemab, it seems, can continue to live well, to socialise, cook, and enjoy holidays and hobbies. in short, to carry on, to some extent, as they always were. Researchers are quick to point out that donanemab is a treatment, not a cure. While it has been hailed as a medical turning point, it neither eliminates Alzheimer's nor resets the clock to the time before it made its presence known. Instead, it slows or halts deterioration, for a time at least. As everyone who has friends or family afflicted with Alzheimer's, or is diagnosed with it themselves, the prospect of any release is cause for celebration. A year's grace might not seem much to a youngster, but in later life, when every day matters, it is priceless. What's more, the advent of donanemab, so soon after that of lecanemab, a recently approved drug in the US, which works on the same lines, suggests that their products are proof of principle, confirming that tackling the build-up of amyloid is the right way, or one of the right ways, of combating this scourge. A further reason to rejoice is that, with so many different pharmaceutical companies racing to the finishing line with their own clinical trials, it seems likely that a raft of different treatments will soon emerge. With scientists confident they are on the right track, these could become increasingly effective as ways to diagnose Alzheimer's and methods of removing amyloid are improved. In light of this, you could view the advent of donanemab as an overture to an opera, preparing the world for a new era in which Alzheimer's would become a manageable condition in the same way as diabetes or asthma. As with every medical breakthrough, of course, it is best not to get too carried away. Reducing amyloid is beneficial only for those diagnosed with Alzheimer's, who must be treated at an early stage. Although it is the most prevalent form of the disease, it accounts for only 60% of dementia cases in the UK, of which there are around 900,000 in total. Other types, of which vascular dementia, Lewy body dementia, frontal temporal dementia and mixed dementia, are the most common and are sadly not helped by such treatment. While the UK's drug watchdog, the National Institute for Health and Care Excellence, NICE, is looking into whether donanemab should become available in the NHS, there is doubt over whether our health system is in a position to identify and treat patients quickly enough. For example, the NHS has half the number of PET brain scanning machines compared to Germany. Nor are there clinics in place to deal with the volume of cases that would need assessing and subsequently treating. It's estimated around 720,000 people could currently benefit. Yet, can the NHS afford not to invest in the equipment, staff and facilities required to turn Alzheimer's from an incurably deteriorating condition to something people can live with? The current cost to the health service of those suffering from dementia, which is the country's leading cause of death, is enormous. Quite how to calculate the cost-benefit of alleviating this affliction is for fiscal experts to determine. Even those of us who count on our fingers, however, are aware that if the NHS fails to find a way to diagnose and treat the huge numbers this affects, it will be consigning the UK's ageing population to a pretty bleak future. Just imagine, for a moment, a time when a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, and perhaps one day all dementias, no longer feels like a death sentence. Already, most of us dread the day when absent-mindedness can no longer explain our memory lapses or change of moods. Jokes about always losing the car keys or spectacles grow less funny the older you get. I suspect we're all tallying our performance in memory, with some days better than others. Essentially, we are conditioned to anticipate eventually falling victim, even though many do manage to elude it. If this form of dementia becomes containable, the outlook for tens of thousands of people every year will be immeasurably improved. For those suffering the horror of early onset Alzheimer's, some of their middle age will be reclaimed. Advancing old age will feel less like a roulette wheel, with the odds of losing your mind stacked against you. At the very least, a society where more than half of dementia cases are treatable will feel like a very different place. Fewer people in care homes at an age when they would otherwise have been at home. Fewer partners living with a loved one requiring round-the-clock support. Fewer families devastated by the loss of the person they once knew, as their mental capacities corrode, surely one of the cruelest of indignities. It sounds like something for the birds, yet that prospect now lies tantalisingly within reach. Political and institutional commitment will be required to make it happen, but there's little doubt that one day it will be here. And that was a comment piece by Rosemary Goring. From the Herald Scotland, Friday the 21st of July 2023, from the politics section. Messages on Boris Johnson's phone recovered by technical experts, by Andrew Learmonth. Technical experts have managed to recover messages on Boris Johnson's old phone, meaning there is now no obstacle to them being handed over to the UK COVID-19 inquiry. WhatsApp messages were sent and received by the former Prime Minister before May 2021, should have been with the official probe last week in order to comply with a High Court ruling. However, the device, which was in Mr. Johnson's possession, could not be accessed. He was told to stop using this phone while in office after the Pop Pitch Gossip newsletter revealed that the number had been freely available on the internet for around 15 years. Mr. Johnson's spokesperson said he had been advised to keep his old phone switched off due to security concerns after it was discovered. However, when he was given the okay to turn it back on, he reportedly could not remember his passcode. Mr. Johnson's spokesman said that he was pleased that the technical experts have now successfully recovered all relevant messages from the device. As repeatedly stated, he will now deliver this material in unredacted form to the inquiry, he added in a statement. They added, the inquiry process requires the security check of this material is now made by the Cabinet Office. The timing of any further progress on delivery to the inquiry is therefore under the Cabinet Office control. It was always the case that Boris Johnson would pass this material to the inquiry and do everything possible to help it be recovered. A careful process approved by the inquiry has been followed to ensure that this was successful. And that article was by journalist Andrew Learmonth. Obituary. Tony Bennett, legendary New York pop and jazz singer, by Alison Kerr. Tony Bennett, legendary New York pop and jazz singer, born August 3rd, 1926, died July 21st, 2023. Tony Bennett, who has died at the age of 96, was a unique figure in the world of pop music, a star who was embraced by successive generations right up until the end of his life. By staying true to his ethos of picking the very best material, he managed to come back and be relevant once more, each time his style of music had fallen out of fashion. During an astonishing 7-decade career, Bennett amassed 20 Grammy Awards and a mountain of hits, among them Rags to Riches, Because of You, his signature song I Left My Heart in San Francisco, and The Good Life, and attracted fans from the worlds of pop and jazz music. While other, younger singers came along and dipped a toe in the Great American Songbook as a token of respect, Bennett championed such great American songwriters as Jerome Kern, the Gershwins, and Cole Porter right through his career, to the point where, once Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald had died in the late 1990s, he was effectively the custodian of those classic standards. He certainly saw himself in that role, and, in 2014, he told the Herald that he felt a responsibility to keep singing those songs. He may already have been well into his 80s, when he took to the stage of the Glasgow Royal Concert Hall in September of that year, but over the course of a non-stop, 75-minute performance, he romped through a programme of no fewer than 26 songs, without pausing for anything more than the briefest chat and acknowledgement of the massive outpouring of affection for him from the packed venue. The bottom line was that he loved to sing, and he loved to make people happy. He cited Louis Armstrong as his primary inspiration as a singer, and explained how he shared Armstrong's outlook. His whole life he just wanted to make people feel good and have fun. He loved what he was doing so much that it never became old-fashioned. Born Anthony Dominic Benedetto in 1926, Bennett first heard Armstrong's recordings as a youngster growing up in the Queens Borough of New York. Before his discovery of jazz, however, It was his father's Caruso records which introduced him to the art of singing, and in particular to the bel canto style, which explains his graceful way with a song and his elegant phrasing. Bennett lost his father when he was only 10 years old, and his mother found herself with three young children and no money. This was 1936, the height of the Great Depression. Music was initially a distraction from the sadness of his father's death, but it soon offered a practical escape route out of poverty. Bennett, whose first job was as a singing waiter, said, "I went into show business to stop my mother from working. She was making a penny a dress sewing in a sweatshop to put food on the table for her children." Bennett was drafted into the US Army in November 1944 and was assigned as a replacement infantryman to the 255th Infantry Regiment of the 63rd Infantry Division, a unit filling in after the Battle of the Bulge. He moved across France and into Germany and, in March 1945, he joined the front line. As the German army was pushed back, Bennett and his company experienced bitter winter fighting and eventually helped liberate a concentration camp. The young singer's combat experience made him a lifelong pacifist. Bennett stayed in Germany as part of the occupying force, assigned to an informal special services band unit, which entertained nearby American forces. Upon his return to the States in 1946, he took advantage of the government's GI Bill of Rights, which provided returning soldiers with free college education. Bennett went to the American Theatre Wing, where he learned what he described as the rudiments of the entertainment world, and where the notion of never compromising on quality was instilled in him. One of his tutors had an office on 52nd Street, then the epicentre of jazz in New York. Her advice proved life-changing. "Don't imitate singers, because you'll just be one of the chorus if you do that. Imitate musicians, find out what they're like." Among the names plastered across the nightclub awnings visible from her window were Art Tatum, Stan Getz, Errol Garner, Billie Holiday, Count Basie and Miles Davis. She told the young Bennett, "Look at these awnings, find out who you like, and then get influenced by listening to how they phrase and what they're doing, and then you'll find your style that way." Bennett zoned in on piano giant Art Tatum, because he made a production out of a song, which wasn't done in those days at all. He'd change the tempo, he'd go to the keys and make the song come alive, and end up telling a story, rather than just singing a straight line for everybody to smoothly dance to. Later, Bennett said, "Stan Getz knocked me out because he had this honey sound, and so I put the two together and arrived at a style that way." In 1950, Bennett handed a demo record to Columbia and was signed on the spot. The following year, his recording Boulevard of Broken Dreams began a run of hits, which also included Because of You, Cold Cold Heart, Blue Velvet, and Stranger in Paradise. By the late 1950s, rock and roll was dominating the pop charts and Bennett's popularity began to flag, only to be reignited in 1962 by his recording of I Left My Heart in San Francisco, a massive hit which paved the way for a string of grown-up, bittersweet ballads such as I Wanna Be Around, The Good Life and The Shadow of Your Smile. By the end of the 1960s, Bennett, like many of his contemporaries, was considered old hat and was under pressure to get on with the contemporary pop music, rock. The album Tony Sings the Great Hits of Today, instigated by his label, made him feel physically sick, and he parted company from Columbia Records in 1972, not to return until 1986. This prolonged period out of the pop limelight produced some highly acclaimed jazz albums on his own improv label. Notably, two albums of much admired duets with pianist Bill Evans, and two sublime volumes of the Rodgers and Hart songbook with the Ruby Braff / George Barnes Quartet. Intimate cult recordings, which are among the very best vocal works in all jazz, and which highlight Bennett's admiration and respect for some of the most eloquent lyrics in the Great American Songbook. By the late 1970s, however, Bennett was at the lowest point in his professional and personal lives. His second marriage broke down, he had developed a cocaine habit and he owed money to the taxman. A near-fatal cocaine overdose was the catalyst for him to ask for help from his sons from his first marriage. Under the astute management of his son Danny, who helped to shift his father's image away from old Vegas, brought him back to New York, sorted out his finances and negotiated a deal with Columbia, which gave him artistic control, Bennett made a triumphant comeback to the pop scene in the late 1980s. He never fell from popular favour again, thanks partly to the fact that he became seen as an elder statesman who almost single-handedly represented the era of Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald, and also because he regularly collaborated with the in-singers of the moment, everyone from K.D. Lang to Lady Gaga, performing standards from his beloved Great American Songbook and making them appeal to a new, young audience. His 1995 Grammy-winning MTV Unplugged record and his famous show-stopping appearance at Glastonbury in 1998 sum up his successful reinvention as someone who, as the New York Times put it, didn't just bridge a generation gap, he demolished it. Bennett told the Herald that the most satisfying aspect of his later success was that it allowed him to be exactly the kind of singer he wanted to be, singing jazz with his quartet and creating an intimate atmosphere even in the largest venue. "I like working that way," he says. "To clarify my whole premise, I don't want to be the biggest. I'd rather be one of the best." The Silver Lining, a tribute to Jerome Kern in which he duetted with pianist Bill Charlap, was released in late 2015 and confirms categorically that he achieved his ambition. It, plus Love for Sale, his 2019 collaboration with Lady Gaga, earned him the last two of his 20 Grammy Awards. Not only was Bennett revered as a singer, he was also a well-regarded and prolific artist. Painting had been his other passion since childhood. He was also passionate about the civil rights movement, with which he was actively involved in the turbulent 1960s, and for which he was recognised on the International Civil Rights Walk of Fame. Earlier, during his wartime service, he had been demoted and reassigned after breaking the army's segregation rules and dining with a black friend. In his later life, he was additionally known for his charitable work, which included the establishment of the Frank Sinatra School of the Arts in Queens, New York, a school for artistically gifted teenagers. Bennett is survived by his third wife, Susan, and by his four children from his first two marriages. By Alison Kerr. From the Herald Scotland, Friday the 21st of July 2023, from the news section, Scottish COVID inquiry lawyer demands answers over expert. This article is an exclusive by Caroline Wilson. The lawyer representing families in Scotland's COVID inquiry has demanded answers about the appointment of an expert witness who touted widely debunked vaccine claims and was described as unconvincing by a High Court judge. Dr. Ashley Croft will present a scene-setting report to the delayed inquiry next week, in which he asserts that it remains unclear if COVID vaccinations resulted in fewer deaths. Research from the World Health Organization in November 2021 showed more than 27,000 deaths in Scotland had been saved by COVID vaccinations at that date. The Herald revealed that just 4 years ago, Dr. Croft, a former advisor to the British military in tropical medicine and infectious diseases, wrote a paper claiming that routine childhood vaccinations could be contributing to increasing rates of autism. Human rights lawyer Amir Anwar has written to Lord Brailsford, who is chairing the inquiry, to express his grave concerns after it emerged Dr. Croft was heavily criticised by a High Court judge in a case involving medical negligence in which he was called as an expert. The case, in 2020, centred on delays by Ministry of Defence doctors in diagnosing a soldier, Darrell Stuart Jones, with HIV. Dr. Croft's testimony, on which the soldier's case was primarily based, was described by a judge as flawed and unreliable, and there was a lack of familiarity with the subject matter. Richard Hermer QC, Deputy Judge of the High Court at the Royal Courts of Justice, wrote, "I was unimpressed with what I consider to be the lack of cogency, consistency and rigour in the opinions expressed by Dr. Croft." Dr. Croft was plainly not an expert in HIV in the sense that he was able to provide an opinion born of expertise garnered from specialised academic, research or clinical experience of the subject. Claims of a link between the MMR vaccine and autism were initially promoted by Andrew Wakefield, a doctor who was subsequently found guilty of fraud and serious professional misconduct. Dr. Croft's CV states that he contributed to UK government inquiries and was awarded a PhD in Pharmacy and Biomedical Sciences from the University of Portsmouth in 2022. In another court case involving a soldier who was charged with a sexual offence, he said the man had not been affected by an anti-malarial drug when he had previously dismissed the importance of side effects. He was commissioned by the Scottish COVID-19 Inquiry to write a report on the accepted scientific and medical understanding of coronavirus and COVID-19 up until the end of 2022. His report is based on 22 pieces of research. Mr. Anwar, who represents the Scottish COVID bereaved group, said concerns over the content of the report and the alarming and disturbing previous criticism by a High Court judge risked undermining public confidence in the inquiry. He writes, "A simple Google of this witness brings up on the first page the High Court judgment. To put it mildly, the criticism of Dr. Croft by the High Court in his role as an expert is devastating. The fact that this witness has been publicly criticised in a High Court judgment should cause alarm for anyone carrying out due diligence in selection of an expert. The Scottish COVID bereaved, whom we represent, fought hard to secure a Scottish inquiry and expected it to be thorough and independent. The families previously lost the confidence of the inquiry headed by Lady Poole. Sadly, this start for the families appears flawed and failing in what the Scottish COVID inquiry was set up to do. Scotland deserves better." Mr. Anwar, who is currently representing families in the UK inquiry, said it was also unclear what purpose Dr. Croft's report would serve. It is described in the inquiry website as a scene-setting presentation, and he will not face questioning. He said, "If it is evidence, in order for the families to effectively participate, we require to be able to ask the inquiry to question this witness. If it is not evidence, what status does the presentation actually hold? To put it bluntly, why have it in the first place?" A spokeswoman for Dr. Croft insisted he was not anti-vax and said he had prepared the report diligently based on the evidence that was available. She added, "He has been instructed as an independent expert." Dr. Croft also concludes that there was insufficient or no evidence to support lockdowns, the test and trace programme, and the use of face masks out with healthcare settings. Professor Neil Mabbott, an expert in immunopathology at the University of Edinburgh, said the evidence presented on COVID vaccines and death focuses on early trials. He said, "Since then, over 13 billion vaccine doses have been administered globally. During their first year of use, between December 2020 and December 2021, it is estimated that they prevented 14.4 million deaths." A spokesman for the Scottish COVID-19 inquiry said it had no comment to make at this time. It emerged earlier this week that Scotland's COVID-19 inquiry has cost almost £8 million so far, despite not yet holding any public hearings. It was set up in February of 2022, but has been hit with a number of delays, including the resignation of Chairwoman Lady Poole, who was replaced by Lord Brailsford. And the article was an exclusive by Caroline Wilson.
The Herald on the 27th of July and the Voices section. Strange Times of a Summer Newsroom by Catherine Salmond. Summer is a strange time in a newsroom. Colleagues pass like ships in the night, take well-earned time off. Desks are left empty. There can be an eerie quietness, yet only for it to be shattered when staff return, often with suntans, occasionally biscuits, and always with tales from far-flung or not-so-distant locations. The usual order of things is suspended for a couple of months, a pattern mirrored across country in many of our institutions, including Holyrood and Westminster, where breaks are in place. And yet the demands of our digital and print products remains the same. We have readers expecting news, comment and analysis. And our priority is, of course, to deliver that. This week, my top pick comes from my politics team, which, with both parliaments in recess, does not have the usual diary commitments to cover. Highlights for me have been the team's in-depth and analytical pieces, many offered through the evening political unspun newsletter, which thousands of readers have delivered to their inboxes every day. My favourites have included Thursdays by our political editor Tom Gordon, who amid a sea of them this week looked up by-elections and asked whether they were a significant indicator of political watershed. His conclusion? Only very few in history could be hailed genuine watersheds, but they really do count. Gordon gave a fascinating look back over political by-election history and explained why. Sounds dry. Absolutely not. It was great. Something we are never short of at the Herald is something to say. No season can get in the way of that. And this week, my next top pick comes from our fantastic opinion section from the very talented Alison Rowett, who manages to make light of a frustrating start to a holiday while weaving in the top topics of Scottish independence, crazy golf and adult-child relationships. This piece was unsurprisingly a top performer on our site, with readers clearly sympathetic to ferry delays and the need for family holidays. My final pick comes from reporter Katrina Stewart, who spoke exclusively with Joyce Landry, the CEO of the charter company responsible for supplying the controversial barge being used to house asylum seekers in Portland, Dorset. Laundry Hibak claims the Bibby Stockholm vessel is a floating prison, telling Stewart the facility, which will house 500 asylum seekers in a bid to alleviate the cost of and pressures on hotel accommodation, is actually quite lovely. It is a topic and a vessel that is attracting media attention from around the world, so I was thrilled for us to secure an exclusive interview. Refugee rights groups have condemned the project, saying conditions on board are inhumane and amount to floating detention. Other readers have expressed a range of views. We will, of course, be following events closely. Enjoy your week. And that was by Catherine Salmond, the editor.
From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 24th of July, 2023, from the news section, A82 crash, man charged after motorcyclist dies in collision, report by Gabriel Mackay. A man was arrested and will appear in court following a fatal car crash on the A82 near Glencoe. The road was closed on Sunday at around noon due to an incident involving a BMW motorbike and a Mazda CX-5. The 35-year-old male motorcyclist was pronounced dead at the scene. His next of kin have been informed. A 52-year-old man was arrested and charged in connection with the collision. He was later released on an undertaking to appear at Inverness Sheriff Court on Tuesday, 25th of July 2023. Inspector Scott Deans for the Road Policing Unit said, "We are continuing our inquiries to understand the full circumstances of what happened. Sadly, the motorcyclist died as a result of this crash and our thoughts are with his family and friends. If you witnessed the collision or have any dashcam footage that may help with our inquiries, I would ask that you contact us as soon as possible. The road was closed for around 7.5 hours, and I would like to thank members of the public for their patience while we investigated this collision. Anyone with information should call Police Scotland on 101, quoting incident number 1435 of Sunday, 23rd of July, 2023. And that piece was by Gabriel Mackay. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 24th of July 2023, from the news section, Rhodes wildfires, up to 10,000 UK residents on island. The first repatriation flights are due to arrive on fire-ravaged Rhodes to rescue British holidaymakers stuck in a living nightmare, with up to 10,000 estimated to be on the island. Airline EasyJet will operate two rescue flights totalling 421 seats on Monday, and a third on Tuesday, in addition to its 9 scheduled flights to the Greek island.
It comes after authorities began evacuating large swathes of the island of Corfu, which is also popular with British holidaymakers, after fire spread there on Sunday. Foreign Office Minister Andrew Mitchell told Times Radio, "The best estimate of the number of British tourists on Rhodes is between 7,000 and 10,000. This is peak holiday season. There were only 10 free beds in the whole island when I asked yesterday, but we think that something like 1,000 beds may well come back on stream today, as others don't now come, and therefore more beds are available." It's important to remember that only 10% of the island is affected by these fires, and therefore it is the tourist companies and the holiday experts who are best placed to give guidance on whether or not a family or individual's holidays are going to be ruined by these events. Meanwhile, a British Foreign Office spokesman confirmed a rapid development team had arrived on Rhodes to support travel operators in bringing Britons home. Some flights out of Rhodes were delayed on Sunday night, including an EasyJet flight due to arrive in Gatwick at 9 p.m, which touched down at 11:30 p.m, after stopping for a crew change in Milan. A later EasyJet flight landed at Gatwick at 2:23 a.m, an hour and a half after it was due, while there were further delays amid the overnight flights from Jet 2 and TUI to Nottingham, Birmingham, Stansted, Manchester and Newcastle. Further EasyJet, Jet 2 and Ryanair flights from Rhodes were scheduled to arrive at Gatwick, Stansted and Bristol on Monday afternoon. On Saturday, families fled their hotels, leaving their belongings behind, as a huge flames crawled closer, with some having to spend the night in local stadiums and schools. Some flight operators, including TUI, continued sending tourists to the island as late as Saturday night, with one customer complaining they had been abandoned there. On Sunday, TUI suspended its flights to Rhodes until Tuesday, while Jet 2 Holidays cancelled its trips until next Sunday. However, EasyJet has maintained a regular service along with fellow budget airline Ryanair, prompting criticism from consumers. A spokeswoman for EasyJet said it was doing all it can to help customers in Rhodes and invited those due to travel to or from the island until Saturday to change their date for free. Helen Tonks, a mother of six from Cheshire, said she was flown into a living nightmare by 2 at 11 p.m. on Saturday and discovered her hotel had been closed. She said she and her family were abandoned and forced to sleep with hundreds of others in a school floor. Ms. Tonks described the decision by airlines to continue their usual service as inexcusable and negligent, putting profit before safety. Previously, the wildfire had been confined to the island's mountainous centre, but, aided by winds, very high temperatures and dry conditions, it spread on Saturday towards the coast and the island's central eastern side. Greek authorities said 19,000 people had been evacuated, with the Ministry of Climate Change and Civil Protection adding, "It was the largest evacuation from a wildfire in the country." Kevin Evans was evacuated twice with his wife and three young children, including a six-month-old baby, on Saturday as the fire rapidly spread. He told the PEA news agency, "We were originally in Kiotari in a villa, but were moved to Gennady about 2 p.m. "There were lots of people in Gennady," said from the hotels. "Many in just swimsuits, having been told to leave everything in the hotel. As the night fell, we could see the fire on top of the hills in Kiotari. They said all the hotels were on fire. About midnight, the fire started moving onto our side of the hill. The alerts were going off again, but not everyone at once, with some people telling us to stay put, and others receiving messages to evacuate. We left at midnight with the big fire very big and close." Dan Jones, a sports teacher from Torquay, had to climb onto a fishing trawler with his sons on Saturday night, describing it as the scariest moment in his life, adding, "What brave boys." Ian Wakefield told Times Radio he spent the night in a school playground in Fallacaraki after being moved from a hotel in Pefki. He said, "It didn't really feel real, being in imminent danger of being burned to death. Between midnight and 5 a.m. this morning, we were going through an evacuation which was pretty chaotic. There were a lot of upset people and children who were understandably quite hysterical. It was all very confusing. The instructions from the hotel manager were unclear. You had to make your own choice in the end. I've had to leave quite a lot of luggage in the hotel. In an update on Sunday, a spokeswoman for the Foreign Office said, "We are actively monitoring the fires and roads and are in close contact with local authorities." The FCDO has deployed a rapid deployment team of 5 foreign FCDO staff and 4 British Red Cross responders to Rhodes to support British nationals whose safety is our top priority. They will be based at Rhodes International Airport to assist with travel documents and liaise with Greek authorities and travel operators on the ground. British nationals in Rhodes should contact the travel operator at the first instance for any queries regarding the rescheduling of flights and continue to check our updated gov.uk travel advice for information. The latest advice on the Foreign Office website said people in Rhodes could contact the Greek government's own crisis management unit. A TUI spokeswoman said the firm's main priority was the safety of customers and its staff. We're doing all they can to help those affected by the fires. And that article is unattributed.
From the Herald, Monday, 24th of July, 2023. Sports section. Harman holds nerve to win Open Championship by 6 shots at Hoylake by Martin McMillan. American Brian Harman survived an early scare to claim his first major title in dominant fashion on a rain-soaked final day of the 151st Open Championship at Royal Liverpool. Harman's 5-shot overnight lead was briefly cut to 3 as he covered the first 5 holes in 2 over par in miserable conditions. But the 36-year-old responded superbly to regain his vice-like grip on the claret jug. A victory made possible by a stunning 65 on Friday, the joint lowest score in Hoylake Open until John Rahm's Saturday 63 was sealed with gritty rounds of 69 and 70 for a total of 13 under par and a 6-shot win over Rahm, Jason Day, Sepp Straika and Tom Kim. Rory McIlroy and Emilio Grillo finished another stroke back with home favourite Tommy Fleetwood and Royal Liverpool member Matthew Jordan in a tie for 10th. It's pretty surreal. It really hasn't sunk in yet, Harman said, as he sat next to the claret jug in his post-event press conference. I'm not going to let it out of my sight for the time being. To win what I consider the greatest prize in golf is just as good as it gets. I'm over the moon. It was a tough last 3 days. It really was. Being able to get some sleep was a big last night. Sleeping on a lead like that is really difficult. So I'm proud of the way I hung in there the last couple of days. Harman, who's just the third left-hander to win the Open after Bob Charles, 1963, and Phil Mickelson, 2013. Last taste of victory on the PGA Tour in 2017. The same year in which he led by 1 after 54 holes of the US Open before finishing 2nd to Brooks Koepka. Only 2 players in championship history have squandered a 5-shot lead after 54 holes. McDonald Smith in the last open stage at Prestwick in 1925 and Jean Vandeveld at Carnoustie in 1999. Harman briefly looked in danger of joining that unhappy club when he dropped a shot on the 2nd before Rahm closed the gap further with a fortunate birdie on the par 5 5th. Rahm's drive was pulled towards a collection of gorse bushes but somehow avoided all of them and left the world number 3 with a good lie and a clear shot from where he came up just short of the green and 2-putted. Harman's tee shot on the 5th then followed the same line as Rahm, only to plunge into a bush and force him to take a penalty drop, leading to a 2nd bogey and cutting his lead to 3. That was Harman's 5th bogey of the week, and for the 3rd time he bounced back immediately with a birdie, holing from 15 feet on the 6th the edge further clear. Another top-quality iron shot set up a birdie on the 7th, restoring Harman's overnight cushion and effectively ending the championship as a contest. And when Straika briefly got within 3 shots thanks to a birdie on the 16th, Harman promptly holed from 40 feet for a birdie on the 14th, and he added another on the next before calmly parring the last 3 holes to seal a convincing victory. McIlroy, who began the day 9 behind, made the ideal start with a hat-trick of birdies from the 3rd, but was unable to make any further inroads and had to settle for a closing 68, his lowest score of the week. They were number two, won the Open at Hoylake in 2014 and the USPGA Championship a month later, but has not claimed one of the game's biggest titles since. Six-time major winner Sir Nick Faldo, commenting for Sky Sports, said, "When he won a quick four, everyone was wondering, is he going to have a dozen, or how close can he get to Jack Nicklaus, who won 18? People think you just roll off a log and win a major, but you don't. I said years ago he would either be ecstatic to get the five or disappointed to only end up with 12. He'd be ecstatic to get the five now. He's talented enough and he's got the desire and is really fit. There's just a couple of things wrong with his short irons. You've got to find a way of clearing the air and finding a way with 8 irons or less." That article was by Herald Online.
This article is from the Herald on Monday, the 24th of July. It's from the opinion section and the headline is "Alex Salmond on Windford Residence and a Hero Betrayed." And the report is by Mark Smith. When you phone Alex Salmond, you know you'll get a decent quote. "The social housing pioneer John Wheatley would be burrowing in his grave," he said. He also said the SNP were missing out on an opportunity for good PR. Neither the administration in Glasgow nor the administration in Edinburgh have their problems to seek. Well, quite. Mr. Salmond also talked about his own experience of social housing. He grew up in a council house in the 1950s and 60s and said it was a great family home and there was no reason why it wouldn't be around for hundreds of years to come. "That first great pre-war wave of social housing," he said, "built some of the best homes in Scotland, and we owe a lot of it, most of it, to John Wheatley." Mr. Salmond was also keen to remind me just how significant Wheatley was and his status as a political hero. The Labour MP's funeral in 1930 was one of the biggest political memorials in Glasgow ever. As a minister in Ramsay MacDonald's government, Wheatley also introduced the first social housing provision at a national level, and it was this that sparked Mr. Salmond's remark about the great radical burrowing in his grave. He also said this: "If Wheatley was alive today, he'd be up there at the flats himself, trying to stop what's happening." Mr. Salmond meant the high flats at Windford in Maryhill, which have become rather famous in the last few months as a battle has emerged between the Housing Association, named, much to Mr. Salmond's annoyance, after Wheatley, and a group of residents calling themselves the Windford Residents Union. The association wants to knock the flats down and build new houses. The Residents Union wants the flats saved and refurbished instead. Mr. Salmond has now pretty heftily come down on the side of the residents and addressed them at a meeting in the local community centre on Saturday, which was why I was phoning him up. Mr. Salmond's argument is that adapting the flats would be cheaper than demolition and that the current plans are driven by a skewed funding system. "It's all about the money," he said. "The policy making is orientated towards grant funding and they're getting tens of millions to knock the flats down." Mr. Salmond contrasted it with the treatment of the residents, who he said had been waved away. What the Wheatley Group say, and I've spoken to them as well, is that the vast majority of tenants of the Windford flats are in favour of the £73 million plans, but this is disputed. One of the residents told me the questionnaire that was sent round was biased towards the development and that many residents have been assumed to be supportive of the demolition because they've moved out, whereas it's possible they just felt they had no choice. The concern some of the residents have, and it's the concern Mr. Salmond has as well, and me, is that by knocking down the Windford flats, we're not really learning the lessons of Glasgow's past. The high rises in the Gorbals, for instance. There's a fantastic film on YouTube at the moment which tells the story of the Elizabeth Square flats and it highlights how complicated buildings of this kind can be. Famously, Sir Basil Spence designed them to be gardens in the sky, but he didn't really reckon with Glasgow's weather or the neglect the flats would suffer and eventually they were pulled down. The question, and it still bugs me today, is whether that was the right thing to do, and the BBC documentary on YouTube makes it clear the answer isn't simple, and opinions were divided at the Gorbals flats just as they are at Wyndford. Some residents found community and friendship in the Gorbals flats and liked living there. Others increasingly felt isolated and even ashamed by them. But there did seem to be agreement on the fact that the flats were poorly maintained, neglected, and then effectively abandoned by the council. There were issues with the design, yes, but neglect led to decay and a self-fulfilling narrative that the only solution was to blow them up. In some ways, looking round the new Gorbals as it is today, I can see the area is better without the Elizabeth Square high-rises. I'm pretty familiar with that part of the city and large parts of it work really well. There are little parks and squares, a thriving row of shops, and crucially, a mix in housing that was deliberately designed so that you can't tell which is social and which is private. There's also a real design flair to lots of the buildings in the new Gorbals, so it looks good too. What's not to like? But the question is, what was the cost, and what will the cost be at Wyndford? Alex Salmond thinks the memory of a political hero like John Wheatley has effectively been betrayed by the association that bears his name. And in a way, I can see where he's coming from. The demolition of Wyndford will lead to the elimination of hundreds of working class homes. On the other hand, the Wheatley Group tell me the homes that will replace them will be affordable, with rent starting at about £400 a month, and everyone who lived in the high rises will be offered a place. This is all perfectly fine, and I'm sure in time the new community will work perfectly well, but I have nagging doubts. The first is on whether the residents were properly consulted rather than presented with a fait accompli. Mr. Salmond told the meeting on Saturday, tongue a bit in his cheek, that what was needed was independence for Maryhill. But what he meant was that communities should have the ability to determine their own future, and I agree with that. The second nagging doubt is about whether there's been a genuine effort to look seriously at the option of retaining the flats. One of the residents told me the buildings are physically fine and could be let out tomorrow if the will was there, and there are eminent architects, Malcolm Fraser, for instance, who agree with that. My fear is that the decision was made to pull them down and then evidence was gathered to justify that decision. But my hope is that the debate is far from over. As one resident put it to me, as long as those flats are up, we have a negotiating position. As soon as they're down, we're screwed. That report was by Mark Smith.
The Herald on the 25th of July and the news section. Scottish COVID inquiry expert row intensifies ahead of start by Caroline Wilson. A campaign group has stepped into the row over the appointment of a vaccine sceptic doctor to lead Scotland's COVID-19 inquiry. Dr. Ashley Croft will present a scene-setting report to the delayed inquiry tomorrow, over 2 days, in which he asserts that it remains unclear if COVID vaccinations resulted in fewer deaths, despite widespread evidence to the contrary. The Herald revealed that just 4 years ago, Dr. Croft, a former advisor to the British military in tropical medicine and infectious diseases, wrote a paper claiming that routine childhood vaccinations could be contributing to increasing rates of autism, research that is now widely discredited. Human rights lawyer Amar Anwar, who is representing bereaved families, has written to Lord Brailsford, who is chairing the inquiry, to express his grave concerns. After it emerged, Dr. Croft was heavily criticised by a High Court judge in a case involving medical negligence, in which he was called an expert. Dr. Croft, who is a leading authority on the treatment of malaria, was asked to compile a factual narrative on the accepted scientific and medical understanding of COVID-19 up until the end of 2022. His report is based on 22 pieces of research and is not thought to have been peer-reviewed. The campaign group Action for a Safe and Accountable NHS, ASAP NHS, has written to the inquiry seeking answers over his appointment. Roger Livermore, founding member and former Crown Prosecutor, said, on what basis was Dr. Croft selected? He is known for his sceptical views on vaccines, particularly concerning when his scepticism was proved to be unfounded. Was he chosen for his views or his connections? Who suggested him? Why? This is a technical report of some importance. Has the report been peer-reviewed? If so, by whom and what were their comments? Dr. Croft seems to have based his summary on a few RCT, randomized controlled tests. RCTs were understandably few in the pandemic. There were few RCTs to draw much by the way of conclusions. The group is calling for an independent regulator to be appointed with investigatory and disciplinary powers to examine serious incidents in the NHS. Scotland is the only part of the UK without one, and the Health and Safety Executive does not have the power to bring criminal prosecutions. Research from the World Health Organization, WHO, in November 2021 showed more than 27,000 deaths in Scotland had been saved by COVID vaccinations at that date. Professor Neil Mabbutt, an expert in immunopathology at the University of Edinburgh, said the evidence presented in Dr. Croft's report focuses on early trials. He said, since then, over 13 billion vaccine doses have been administered globally. During the first year of use, between December 2020 and December 2021, it is estimated they prevented 14.4 million deaths. A spokeswoman for Dr. Croft insisted that he is not anti-vax, and he said he recognised that vaccines had led to the virtual eradication of diseases such as polio. She said she had prepared the report diligently and was instructed as an independent expert. In the past few days, following the Herald articles, an update has been published on the inquiry website addressing some of the concerns around Dr. Croft's report and appointment. In states, the court participants will be given the opportunity to question his election and report findings at a later stage. It states, "We have not provided an opportunity at this stage for questions to be put to Dr. Croft. Next week's proceedings will be led by our senior counsel, Stuart Gale, KC, taking Dr. Croft through his material and putting questions to him. An opportunity will be provided in due course for call participants to apply to the inquiry for questions you may wish to put to Dr. Croft with regard to his presentation. We have received queries as to Dr. Croft's expertise. Core participants are, of course, entitled to question the expertise of any and all persons who provide information to the inquiry. Where there are particular matters of substance that you may wish to address with Dr. Croft, this can be dealt with through an application to the inquiry. Scotland's COVID-19 inquiry has cost almost £8 million so far, despite not yet holding any public hearings, data shows. It was set up in February of 2022, but has been hit with a number of delays, including the resignation of Chairwoman Lady Poole, who was replaced by Lord Brailsford. And that was by Caroline Wilson. The Herald on the 25th of July in the news section. Edinburgh Zoo welcomes six Asian small clawed otter pups by Gabriel Mackay. Six Asian small clawed otters have been born at Edinburgh Zoo and recently received their first health check. Two of the animals, named Barry and Luna, arrived at the zoo in 2020 as part of the European Endangered Species Programme, EEP, and have since had four litters of pups. Asian small clawed otters, the smallest species of otter in the world, and are listed as vulnerable by the International Union for Conservation of Nature, IUCN. The zoo recently welcomed six more of the otters, bringing the total to 14. Expert vets at the Wildlife Conservation Charity confirmed they are five boys and one girl. At just 9 weeks old, the pups are still dependent on their mother and are spending most of their time in the underground holts, the zoo said. Lucky visitors might be able to see them exploring their enclosure and learning more about their surroundings in the coming weeks. Alison McLean, carnivore team leader at Edinburgh Zoo, said that "We are delighted to welcome our newest additions, who are already proving to be very feisty. Barry and Luna arrived at the zoo in 2020 and have previously shown themselves to be very attentive parents. They can often be seen swimming and diving with their older pups in the stream in their enclosure. With the addition of the new arrivals, we now have 14 Asian small-clawed otters here at the zoo. The species live in family groups consisting of a mum and dad, then their older offspring who help raise the younger ones. The Asian small-clawed otter naturally lives in a range from parts of India to Southeast Asia, including the islands of Sumatra, Java, Borneo, and Palawan. It lives in freshwater wetlands such as swamps, slow-flowing rivers, and rice fields, and can also be found in estuaries, coastal lagoons, and tidal pools. They feed largely on crustaceans and fish, but will also eat snakes, frogs, insects, and small rodents in the wild. They face threats due to loss of habitat, poaching for their fur, and pollution of water due to pesticides. And that was by Gabriel McKay.
That concludes this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and to tell your friends about our service.